where I would like to start first today in lecture is to try to wrap up the entropy thermodynamics chapter and then work our way backwards to a couple of topics that I hadn't finished addressing before. Since the exam's happening today, I didn't want to talk too much about acid-base examples because I didn't want to possibly confuse anyone. But there are a couple specific topics in acids and bases that I needed to come back to. One was related to the salt-type problems that would be potentially on the exam. For example, if we had sodium acetate, being able to recognize that sodium's not going to affect the pH, recognizing acetate as the conjugate base of a weak acid, so that means acetate is itself basic. That's the style of problem we've already discussed now. But what if you have a salt like ammonium acetate? Ammonium is acidic. Acetate is basic. So what is that going to mean for the resulting mixture? That's one thing that we need to do. Polyprotic acids, acids that dissociate more than once, I've totally avoided talking about them so far. It turns out it's not that difficult to deal with them, but like I said, I would like to address it after the exam. But for those of you who did read the acid-base chapter, you might have yourselves noticed those two very specific topics that I've so far skimmed over. So we'll come back to that. In the context of lecture, we never did finish going over a method of initial rates problem. I talked about it, I did much of the problem, but didn't finish it, never got around to it, and then got focused on the lab calculations, so never finished it in lecture. That will be one additional topic that I need to come back to. So between today and Wednesday, I'd like to try to finish all that, to leave Friday the time to be able to review for the final, or if there is any last-minute small discussion that we need to do. So there's no new chapters coming. No, like I said, no squeezing in of infinite amount of information. We're just going to go back and do a little cleanup. So we're going to start, like I said, with the entropy chapter. And I'd like to put into equation form something that I've said out loud at different points in the quarter. So looking through the textbook, acknowledging the textbook order of things, in section one, we dealt with a lot of concept. To be honest, I don't even think on the final a lot of this concept is going to make it on there because it's pretty hardcore and it's at the end of the quarter. So, but there is this one equation that's in the section there that I would like to tell you about, and I believe it's an example I might have started drawing, but I don't recall how far in that conversation we got. So this is one way of describing entropy, this example. And I say that because you might recall when we did the theoretical discussion, I said that there's this equation which is the Boltzmann equation, where you can take the number of possible arrangements of microstates and from that calculate an entropy. So that's the statistical method for doing it. But there's this other way of trying to do a measurement in lab where you're not trying to calculate, you're just directly measuring. And so that's what I'm drawing here. And this again is in section one of the text. Hold on just one moment. Okay, so in this example, what you have is a gas that is inside of a piston. So in other words, the top here can go up and down. And on top of that, you've got a beaker that's filled with sand. And the thought puzzle is, what will happen if one little grain of sand at a time is taken off of the top of this sand pile. And we do it one at a time, one at a time, one at a time, to mimic what is known as a reversible or infinitesimally reversible process. Now, that would, to just oversimplify it, would be some of the minimum amount of disorder you could imagine happening in the system, because the system is so carefully expanding one little grain at a time. It turns out that as this expansion occurs, there's going to be heat that's absorbed from the surroundings. So as this goes up and the gas expands, heat comes in. So what's the point of this example? Well, it turns out that you can calculate the entropy change that's going on in the system by simply looking at the heat change that's going on in the system. So in this example, I want to use the buzzwords in print. In this example, a cylinder is undergoing an infinitesimal expansion. Translated into English, that means a perfect reversible expansion. No waste of energy whatsoever. There's a reason that we talk about these perfect expansions versus imperfect expansions, but that gets really deep into thermodynamics, and we don't have the context for that here. In a physics class or a physical chemistry class, you would go over something like that, and famously there's a process known as the Carnot cycle. So if you've had physics already, you have already heard of that kind of thing. So getting back to this. It turns out the equation is this, that for the system, the change in entropy that occurs, in this kind of case where all that's going on is expansion, is this heat that's absorbed under reversible conditions divided by temperature. So let me translate this. This is the heat that is absorbed under these ideal expansion conditions. Now, the whole point of this discussion, to try to give context to the theoretical part that I discussed before, what we had discussed is that when we open up a container, we give more room, then that gives many, many, many more ways that molecules can be dispersed throughout that system. So it creates a slew of microstates. It creates the disorder, to put it one way, but the spreading out of energy, the spreading out of matter. And out of all those possible states, it turns out is much more favorable for this expansion to occur. But even if you did this expansion and there's no chemical reaction going on, that increase in entropy that occurs has an effective energetic impact. And that's what this cylinder expanding is trying to show us, that nothing more than the gas fighting against gravity, fighting against the sand, nothing more than physically some work going on, that's causing heat to be absorbed, and all that's happened is a change in entropy. So that's where this equation comes from. And that's the one part of section one that we didn't quite wrap up. Now, because I'm referring to section one, it does go through phase changes, describing how entropy changes in those situations. It talks about making solutions and how that's a big change in entropy. So we've addressed the other parts of section one. Now, section two brings up this same equation again, and it brings it up in the context of the first law. It says that let's say that we don't know what the process is that's going on inside a system, but we can talk about what happens outside a system. And let me show you what I mean. We know that from the first law, that change in energy in an isolated system must be equal to zero, but it could be equal to two different heats. And what I mean is this, in the calorimetry example, classic case where you have a hot piece of metal, a little cube of iron or copper or something that's been heated up, and let's say that you put it in water. So let me specify and say the metal starts out hot. We heated it up. The water, let's say that it is cold. And so we can say that the Q total is equal to zero if this is an ideal system. And I'll put that in as a caveat. So we have this ideal isolated system where the total is equal to zero, but that's equal to the heat the metal is going to release because it's hot, plus the heat that the water is going to absorb because it's cold. So in other words, you're always going to get delta E is equal to zero is equal to Q system plus Q surroundings. And so that means that the entropy change for the surroundings is going to be the negative of the system's enthalpy change divided by temperature. And let me help explain why this equation is different. It is, does not depend on the process in the system. It's a state function. So before we were talking about this ideal reversible heat. Now we've replaced this with whatever the system's heat change is, and now talking about the impact on the surroundings. And the reason I had these equations up above is that if this whole thing is happening in like a larger system, where you have this, you have a system and surroundings, but then you have the universe. Change energy, the universe will be zero, but that means that the system, whatever it absorbs, the surrounding releases, or vice versa. So Q from one direction is just the opposite of the other. That's where this negative sign is for the entropy change for the surroundings. But the one part that may be hard to catch is why did I go from Q reversible to H system? So above we were talking about this ideal case of expansion to talk about the fact that a change in entropy has an impact on energy. That's how to translate this equation into English. A change in entropy alone has an impact on energy. And that's kind of the whole point of the example of ammonium nitrate dissolving in water. Remember, that's the case of a salt going into water and it ends up absorbing energy so the water gets cold. But why does the process still happen? Because it creates a mess. It creates disorder. And that disorder is like a release of energy. That's the way I'd explained it. And so same thing here. A change in entropy alone has an impact on energy. That's effectively what I'm saying. So down below, now we're not in this, the change of enthalpy for the system. Now we're not so worried about whether it's an entropy change or whatever it is, it's what's going on inside of the system in terms of its heat change. So if a system absorbs heat from the surroundings and nothing is happening to the surroundings, there's the way to say it. Kind of the opposite case. Now it's the surroundings that aren't being affected except by entropy. And so now that's where the negative sign comes from, but it's the same format of equation. Maybe if I get to the point, that'll help. The point is this. First law says that enthalpy is conserved. You can't create energy from just nothing. The second law of thermodynamics states that the sum of the entropy change of a system versus the entropy change of the surroundings must be greater than zero in any spontaneous process. Suppose, like this example of ammonium nitrate dissolving, you have energy being absorbed in. So that process is counterbalanced by the entropy change of the solution being formed, the fact that you're making a mess. But the equation before that I just showed on the previous page would say, oh, well, the surroundings entropy change is going to be affected. And in fact, it's going to be, it's going to have a negative entropy change because heat's being absorbed away from the system. So there's enough entropy change going on in making that solution that it makes up for that fact. And that's the second law of thermodynamics. Now here we go with a little bit of mathematical trickery, which is what comes up in section 3. Because it defines this work function, free energy function. And what it does is it says this. It says that the energy change of the universe, which sounds fancy, but this just means the system and surroundings, which means everything. Well, that's the entropy change for the system plus the entropy change for the surroundings. Okay. So now we make a substitution because we just got an equation on the previous page for this entropy change of surroundings. It's equal to negative H of the system divided by T. Okay, so we rewrite this equation. We get delta S of the universe is equal to delta S of the system minus delta H of the system divided by T. And then we multiply both sides by negative T. And what we'll get is negative T delta S of the universe is equal to negative T delta S of the system minus or plus delta H of the system. Now, how to say this next one? One moment. Now, okay, so this is where your book skips a step. Remember I said that there's Thermodynamics that comes from statistics, looking at all the molecules wiggling around. That's where that Boltzmann equation comes from. And then there's like old school in the lab physical measurements that don't even depend on what molecules are. So there's a thing called a Gibbs function. And what this says is that the amount of energy available to a system depends on the enthalpy change of the system adjusted for the effects of entropy. Now, we already have delta H in this equation up above. We already have T delta S in this equation up above. And so this equation that you've seen me use before somewhere in the quarter is this. Delta G of the system is equal to delta H of the system minus T delta S of the system. Okay, now what does this mean in English? Well, remember that this delta S that we started with over here, the one I'm about to highlight, that has to be greater than zero. Entropy change must be a positive value. Now we've thrown a negative T in front of it. That's why delta G must be less than zero, because it is the same thing as being related to entropy. So I don't know how to say this to make it make more sense other than maybe to do it again on Wednesday, where maybe the language will come to me. But these two concepts of entropy changing and how much energy is available, that's the whole point of this free energy equation. And then we've already talked about the consequences of this. We've talked about how if you did have a reaction that released energy, delta H is negative, and made a mess, delta S is positive, then it's pretty much guaranteed to happen at any temperature. Whereas if a reaction absorbs energy, delta H is positive, and if it tries to become more ordered, delta S is negative, then the reaction won't occur no matter what the temperature is. And that's the point of delta G. It predicts which way the reaction's going to go. Now, am I going to ask you to derive this equation? Probably not. But I felt like I needed at least try to get through this explanation. Because then we get to the practical. We get to the last section of the chapter, which is where I wanted to really end up with today. So, given that this is kind of confusing, and even if you have questions, probably all you're thinking is, when is he going to stop talking so we can take the exam? So let's get to that section four then. That is what you all are thinking, right? No. Dr. Gray, what we're thinking is, can't you just give us the points and let us graduate?
Exactly.
Yeah. Then when you fail your next course, how happy will you be with me then? Happier than we are now. So, Section 4 starts out with a discussion of Q and K again. And there's this one reaction. This is the one reaction that I know I should know from somewhere. And it stopped updating, didn't it?
Is your screen frozen?
Yeah, I just realized it. I was trying to fix it right then. There we go. So, delta G equal to RT ln of Q over K. What does this mean? The amount of energy available in reaction depends on how far the reaction is from equilibrium. Let's say the reaction is at equilibrium. Q is equal to K. Delta G is therefore equal to RT ln of 1, which is equal to 0, which is one of the definition of equilibrium, the way that I describe the state of equilibrium. Lowest energy point. There is nothing lower than the lowest, so no energy change. Now, what if Q is greater than K? That means Q over K is greater than 1. That means delta G is greater than 0. That means non-spontaneous. What if Q is less than K? Well, then Q divided by K is less than 1, which means delta G is less than 0, which is spontaneous. It's like, well, you've told us this already, Dr. Gray. You've been showing us those silly graphs all quarter. Yeah, but we're now finally leading up to that graph. Because let me do a little trickery. Delta G is going to be equal to RT ln of Q minus RT ln of K. Now, does anybody remember anything? What is Q? Q, the reaction quotient. You know Q versus K like we did earlier in the equilibrium chapter? Exactly that same Q. So now, question. What is the standard state? Oh, I could have sworn you must have had this some quarter or another. So, modern definition, 25 degrees Celsius, 1 bar pressure, 1 molar concentration of ions. 1 molar concentration of ions. 1 bar pressure, 1, 1, 1, 1. So Q at the standard state. Always equals 1. Because you'll have 1 raised to the whatever power times 1 raised to whatever power divided by 1 raised to whatever power. In other words, it doesn't matter what the reaction is. If the standard state is that everything's equal to 1, that means Q is equal to 1. So that means that delta G of the standard state is equal to RT ln of 1 minus RT ln of k, which is therefore equal to negative RT ln of k. So I didn't explain the details before, but this equation you've seen multiple times. Delta G, more correctly, delta G naught, is equal to negative RT ln of k. Now you might be saying, okay, wait, you've been really loose then with delta G versus delta G naught. Can you make sense of the two of them? Sure. On the next page, once you have your screenshots. Because what if you're not at the standard state? How do we calculate the energy change then? Well, we just got that. What did we just get? Oh, yes, the delta G is equal to RT ln of Q minus RT ln of K. But we also got that delta G naught is equal to negative RT ln of K. So that means delta G is equal to RT ln of Q plus delta G naught, or delta G is equal to delta G naught plus RT ln of Q. Now, I'm going to do one more step than what the book does even to help explain this difference between delta G and delta G naught. Let's say that delta G is less than 0, which means K is greater than 1. Here are delta G and delta G naught put on the same reaction progress diagram. Where the y-axis is now officially free energy. Because that's what this still is. All along I've been saying this is a type of potential energy graph. The only thing that I've been a little bit sloppy with is talking about delta G versus delta G naught. Delta G meaning what is the true amount of energy available for the reaction. And that is different from the amount of energy available at the standard state. The standard state is going to mean that Q is equal to 1. But where the reaction really is the true value of Q, the one that you might be given in a problem. And so if Q is in fact less than 1, that means there's more energy available than what you might have calculated. If it's greater than 1, well, it depends on how much greater than 1 to see if there's even any energy left. Or if you're going to have to, in fact, push the reaction uphill to continue going forward. That is the last thought in the thermodynamics chapter.